Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is Tanya Engst, Editor-in-Chief and also CFO of Tidbits Publishing. Tanya, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and thanks very much for having me here.
Thank you very much for being on the show. Okay, so I think all the listeners are familiar with Tidbits, but I want to go back in time, as I always do, John, the time machine guy, and sort of got to get a sort of historical background and perspective on all the things that happened before Tidbits Publishing. So tell us about what was happening in your life before you got started with this, and maybe some of the things that inspired you, or some of the jobs that you had, or technical training that kind of like helped you out in all this.
Well, let's see. I was lucky enough to attend Cornell University in the mid-1980s, and I was also lucky enough to meet a guy named Adam at a dance on the first day of freshman year. And Adam and I became friends during college, and in fact, dated during most of college. In college, we both really enjoyed the fact that Cornell was very early onto the internet, and we both enjoyed learning a whole lot about the Macintosh computer. And in fact, when we graduated, for both of us, we felt that our most marketable skill was that we could run a Macintosh computer shortly after.
Did desktop publishing revolution kind of drive this?
Yes, to a large degree. We both were on the board of the literary magazine at Cornell, and we would create issues using PageMaker for the interiors where we were playing around with desktop publishing. And then we'd go down in the basement of one of the dorms, and we would use a hand press to do the covers.
So it's starting to come into focus now about how it all got started. It's a very natural thing.
Very natural. I, in fact, majored in communications, where I had classes in desktop publishing, where Adam actually picked an independent major in what was called then hypertextual fiction, which is kind of like if you put a book on the web, only there was no web then.
Hypertext?
Yes.
What? Fill us in.
Hypertextual fiction. It's just like if you wrote a book, but instead of the reader turning pages in a linear way, the reader comes to questions or ideas along the way where they can click different links to read the story in a different order, basically branching in the story.
Doesn't sound like something that really took off, or did it?
Well, I'd say that a lot of books that you read on the web nowadays basically are hypertextual fiction because you wouldn't necessarily have to read things in order.
Okay. All right. So then what happened?
Well, then what happened is we graduated from Cornell. I got a job at Cornell selling computers to people who needed computers, Next machines, Macintoshes, IBM PCs. Adam was an independent consultant working on databases and helping people back up their Macs, things like that. And I came home one day and I said, the people I work with, they don't know enough about their computers, especially Macintoshes, and they don't have Macs at home, and they just don't care enough, and they don't know enough about the news. And I am going to use PageMaker to make them a weekly newsletter to tell them what they really ought to know.
Tell us about PageMaker. Tell us what PageMaker, because some people don't go for it that far back.
Well, PageMaker was just the groundbreaking, amazing program that you could use to do desktop publishing on a Macintosh. So you could create professional quality things like posters, brochures, books, newsletters, you name it. Using software and working on a computer screen, you could have your choice of fonts. You could move blocks of text and images around on the page to put them just exactly where you wanted to, which was really revolutionary at the time. Before we had desktop publishing software on computers that actually allowed you to pick what font you were looking at, you basically had to type up all this stuff or mock it up kind of by hand on paper, with paper being taped onto other pieces of paper and kind of making a photo image of what you wanted.
I remember that. I worked on a magazine called Peelings 2.
Sure.
And we wrote the articles. This was in the 80s. And we wrote the articles on Apples with Apple Writer. Mm-hmm. And so we could edit the text and so on. But when we were done, what we had was just simple text. And then you had right. to use scissors and wax and so on and do a layout board.
That's right.
Right. And the so when the Mac, so what you're saying is when the Mac came along and this program, what you could actually do was start stitching things together electronically, like images and ads and text and wraparound.
Yeah, and if there was an image and you thought maybe it should go in the upper right-hand corner, you could just kind of paste it up there and see what it looked like. And then if it didn't look very good, you could cut it out and stick it in the lower left-hand corner. Whereas with the wax setup, like what you're describing, it was just quite a bit more fussy. Mm-hmm. I recall working with tape that you could like tape down and pull up as many times as you wanted to. But the whole thing was just much more clumsy on paper. And people who did layout were very quick to switch to desktop publishing because it was just awesome. And of course, the typography, the way you could have fonts at all these different sizes, and you could try them out small, try them big, wrap text around graphics. It was,
what was
really
the company
very
that
great
did this
time
program?
To be alive. Sorry, what was that?
What was the company?
Aldis originally.
Right. So did they get bought up? I forget.
Adobe.
That's right. Did Adobe do well in absorbing it, or did they improve it greatly, or did they work on a competitor, or what did they do?
Well, let me see. It seems to me that Adobe has had PageMaker ever since, and in fact, it's still a viable product.
Really? I've lost track of that completely. I didn't know that.
And they've kept improving it over the years. Obviously, there's been huge amounts that have happened with color, and of course with making ebooks, and people, you know, having demands on it for, you know, both very small projects and also, you know, very huge projects where you might be printing hundreds of thousands of copies of something on a professional press.
So how did PageMaker fit into then your efforts to educate Mac users?
Well, not especially well, as it turns out. After I gave this idea and shared this idea with Adam, he said, well, that's great, but I think you should do that, but I am going to also use your articles in a form of this newsletter, and I'm going to publish it in HyperCard, and I'm going to share it on the internet with all these other people reading some of the Usenet news groups about the Macintosh. And it'll be really cool because all these people all over everywhere can read this thing. And I said, great, that's a super idea. Let's do it. And we did. And that was Tidbits issue number one. And Tidbits issue number two came out a week later. And that was the end of PageMaker.
Set the stage here now. What year was this?
This was 1990.
So we had the Usenet groups.
Yes. But
we didn't have the commercial internet until 1996, 97?
A little before that. But yeah. Main point is, we didn't even have the idea of the web. We just really didn't. So the whole idea that you could even publish a newsletter over the internet was pretty new. As far as we know, Tidbits, for many years, Tidbits, we believed, had the honor, I guess, of being the second newsletter to have been published over the internet. The first one was from some folks from Ireland who published a newsletter in the United States for folks who had immigrated here from Ireland. We were the second, and we published our HyperCard stack over Usenet News and BBS systems. Do you remember BBSs?
Oh, yeah. Bulletin board systems. You dial in with a modem, right?
That's right. We were on Delphi and Bix and CompuServe, AOL, all those.
Oh, lovable CompuServe. Yes.
There was a time when your business card, you would, of course, want your email address on your business card, but it wasn't just that. You'd get all your handles for where people could reach you on the different big systems like AOL and CompuServe. And, you know, sort of the more you had, the cooler it was.
Mm-hmm. And so, and even Apple had one, too. Forget the name.
That is right. We'll think of the name of that one in just a moment. They had quite a few Apple online services over the years. But we were very early publishing Tidbits, and
did you charge people for downloading that?
Tidbits actually has always been free. but we have had to find some ways to make some money from doing it because it's really quite a bit more than a hobby. It's very time consuming and very fun, but there's no way we could do it without earning money from it. So in fact, we were, as far as we know, the first publication on the internet to come up with advertising. We did it very gently at first because advertising was very new at the internet. We used NPR as kind of a model for us, and we let people sponsor issues of Tidbits. And that worked very well for us for quite a long time. But in the last 5 years, that model has not been working as well. So we actually set up a Tidbits membership program so that people could voluntarily give us some money, a small amount or a large amount. People can kind of pick what amount. And we use that money to pay for Tidbits' most important expenses now. We still have sponsorships, and we really love our sponsors, but it just hasn't been as big of a draw as it was back in the 90s when we first got started.
You said something very interesting. You mentioned NPR.
Yes.
Back when people were first thinking about desktop publishing and internet and changing the way people read things, there was always that analog that was something that inspired you. For us at Peelings, it was Consumer Reports. You know, we wanted to evaluate software. Other people had inspirations, maybe certain magazines that they thought were cool, like Car and Driver, and they wanted to be like them and instantiate that on the internet. So I was particularly interested to hear about how you know, like initially modeled yourself after NPR, because there was a time when nobody knew where they were going and how they were going to do these things. And the only thing they had at their hands was the cool technology in front of them and things that inspired them as an analog in the rest of the world. Is that how you felt?
Well, the NPR inspiration was very much for how we could gently do some form of sort of advertising where we could make money creating this content. And keep in mind, back in the 1990s, collecting money over the internet was extremely challenging, particularly for a small firm like Adam and I running a business. The whole, you know, having an e-commerce cart on the web, that wasn't even possible when we came up with this idea of having sponsors. So as far as the actual content of Tidbits goes, I think that we were strongly inspired by Mac Week, by Mac User, by Macworld, by Byte, just by all the collection of publications that were available at that time. And we always wanted to give people a relevant summary of what's going on and to help them figure out how to better use the gear that they had.
Who were some of the contemporaries that you were working with or inspired by at the time? Certainly, well, maybe John Dvorak. He was early on.
Yeah, I think we were, in fact, so early that we were basically kind of the first as far as online people. Mm-hmm. We both thought that Mac User was pretty much the coolest magazine on the planet. Mac User was absorbed, quite a while ago into Macworld. But at one time, Mac User and Macworld were different magazines. And we were just so excited when at some point along the way, Mac User asked us to write articles for them too. We thought that was, you know, we'd really arrived. That was just about the coolest thing that had ever happened to us.
And so you formed this partnership and you became sort of like this, as you said, the CFO and the finance person.
Right. Well, along the way, as Tidbits was growing, we actually moved from Ithaca, New York, where Cornell University is. We moved to Seattle, and I acquired a real job at Microsoft doing tech support for Microsoft Word. And Adam, we got married right about then when we moved. Adam came out to Seattle with me, and he began to devote himself more fully to Tidbits because he didn't want to get one of those real jobs. So we continued in that vein for a while. I plan to personally make Microsoft a better place for Macintosh users. Hooray. And did my level best in the trenches of Microsoft Word
support. The verdict is still out on that.
I have to say that learning Microsoft Word backwards and forwards, plus really learning a lot about how to do customer support, those two things, which were it was the kind of job you have in your 20s. It was a difficult job, and I learned a lot, and the things that I learned have benefited me my entire career, and I'm not sorry at all that I did it. And I think I do have a pretty unique perspective on how Microsoft operates, although, you know, at this point it's been a long time. Yeah. So people shouldn't call me and ask me questions about Microsoft Word because it has been a long time. But during that time, Adam had the good fortune to be asked to write a book about the internet. And he wrote what turned out to be the fifth book available about the internet and one of the very first for the Mac. And in fact, one of the very first to describe using the internet through a Macintosh's operating system instead of through Unix. And his book also came with a flat rate access to a flat rate internet account. So you could call a not 1-800 number, but you could call a number and access the internet for a fixed rate every month instead of having to pay, you know, by the byte or the bit or whatever it was.
Very nice.
So his book was pretty popular, and that brought a lot of attention to Tidbits. And in fact, his book was so popular that I quit my job at Microsoft.
That's cool.
That was pretty cool. Yeah. So that just launched this amazing kind of 5 to 10 year period of time in our lives where we're living in Seattle. There's a lot of energy around the early internet in Seattle. And we're seeing what we can do with this book Adam has written and with this Tidbits, which we have converted to the web at this point. You know, we had to convert all the old HyperCard issues into the web. And we have a wonderful time with this. This was an amazing time and place to be alive. And we made friends with a lot of authors who were living in Seattle at that time, who were doing interesting things. We both wrote more books, and I began to edit some books as well.
I think this is just a perfect time to take a break here because we're about halfway through, and we're just about to launch into a different tangent here with books. And
yes.
So I want to take a quick break. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we are back. Thanks, Kelly. So before the break, we were launched onto books and some books that you and Adam were both writing. And tell us more about how that got going and some of the books that you guys wrote. And was that fueling your career at this point, the book revenue?
Oh, certainly. The Internet Starter Kit that Adam wrote was a bestseller and made us a small chunk of change, but big enough that, as I said, I was able to quit my job and we were able to confidently move forward into the idea that we could be internet publishers. But we also wrote quite a few print books. We wrote, well, I say we, actually, we wrote independently. I wrote books about Microsoft Word. I wrote a book called Create Your Own Homepage. And I became involved in editing quite a few books from Peach Pit Press. We really enjoyed working with Peach Pit through many years. And the only problem with all the editing and all these paper books was at this point, which I'd say is starting to move into the late 1990s and early 2000s, the problem is the pace of software development begins to pick up, and it starts to become very, very difficult to finish a book, have it laid out with desktop publishing software, printed, put onto UPS trucks, and shipped to Barnes and Noble and the like. By the time you finish the book,
it's out of date.
Already outdated.
Yes, yes.
And it's, and you're staying up, you know, you're working ridiculous hours. And even though some books are bestsellers, like Adam's book, many are not especially bestsellers, and you're working very hard for what may come out to be essentially minimum wage. And your books are being pulped because they cannot be made available and purchased and consumed fast enough before they're obsolete. So this is not working very well. And in the fall of 2003, Adam and I sort of had this realization that we didn't need to publish the books as print books anymore. We didn't need to work with a publisher like O'Reilly or Peach Pit or any of those anymore, that we could be our own publishers and we could make ebooks ourselves and we could sell them online. Because at this point, some changes had happened with e-commerce where you could, as a very small vendor, sell something for only $5 or $10 and not end up paying the credit card company so very much in fees that there'd be no point in doing it. So we started to, basically, we came up with a system for creating an ebook.
Tell me about that, because before you were doing PageMaker, and then you were editing books probably in Word to, to Peach Pit, and now next generation technology is to compose these ebooks. How did you do that?
Well, we were fortunate enough to get into the gig early when there was only one format that anybody cared about, and that's the PDF, the portable document format. That's the format that Preview on the Macintosh works with. Adobe Reader works with it. Other computers besides Macintoshes can also use PDFs very easily. So if you've got a Windows computer, for instance, there's no issue with opening a PDF. And in fact, if you're very, very good at using Microsoft Word, which I was at that time particularly good at it because I still remembered everything, you can just print to PDF right from Microsoft Word, and you've got yourself a pretty good PDF. And in fact, we did some very tricky, crazy stuff with Word for Windows and Word for Mac, putting their features together so we could make PDFs that had clickable links in them so people could move around within the PDF to areas of interest very readily. Mm-hmm. And so we could put a whole lot of web links into those PDFs too, so we could tell people, you know, if you want more information, here's this great Apple article from the Apple Knowledge Base online, or here's a Tidbits article, or in fact, here's a Mac Observer article. We're really looking more for the best article. And so we were able to take, as I said, like to put it, put the E into the ebook. It's not just that we've made a print book and then sort of made a PDF from it as an afterthought. We've created a PDF with the idea that it might never get printed, or if it did get printed, the print aspect of it would be an afterthought. Now, so we launched.
Is this the beginning of your own book publishing and then Take Control from Other Authors came later?
No, this was Take Control from the beginning. Mm-hmm. We were aware that Apple was going to be shipping, macOS 10, 10.3 Panther. And we got together with four authors who we were friends and or colleagues with. And we persuaded four people to each write one book. It could be a short book, we said. It didn't have to be a big, long book with a wide spine so it would show on a bookstore shelf. And we wanted them to just go very deep into a topic that we felt would be of interest. So we got Joe Kissel, who is very well known these days, to write us a book about upgrading to Panther. And we got Matt Newberg to write one about customizing Panther. And we got Kirk Mikkelhern to write one about users and accounts, which was a big deal back then because nobody could figure out how to do Unix-style accounts on our Macintoshes. And we got Glenn Fleischman to write about sharing files. And so we had these four books, and we released them very shortly after Apple put out Panther, which was a bigger deal then because we didn't have all these public betas. And we thought, well, you know, if we sell 1,000 books in a year, like, that would be pretty cool. You know, that would make it sort of worth the effort of this funny project. And we sold 1,000 books in 24 hours.
That's amazing.
So we thought, we may be onto something here.
Maybe.
And things just really took off from there. We rapidly had to deal with all the problems that publishers deal with. And of course, when we started this series, we wanted it to be a great series for authors. So contracts in the publishing world are always a very big deal, and, you know, getting a good deal from your publisher, making sure your royalties. And we actually created the contract with the four original authors. Everybody worked together to create a contract that everybody thought was fair and good. And there are some things about it.
So the authors you worked with were partners with you in defining what you thought a good ebook contract should look like?
Yes, exactly. And also, we wanted everyone to have the same terms because it was going to be too confusing for Adam and I to keep track of, like, well, this guy got, you know, 40% and this other guy got 47%. And we just said, well, we just said everybody gets the same. It's a 50-50 split between the author and the publisher, which, by the way, is an amazingly good royalty for the author. But we were able to cut out all the distribution costs. So even though the author is getting this fabulous royalty because we're not contending with the whole world of print publishing, it's still great for the publisher too. It's completely fine. And we still have basically the same contract that we had back from the beginning, and everybody agrees to the same contract. Awesome. That's been pretty neat. There are some things in the contract that maybe in hindsight I might not have done, but it is an author favor, you know, it's a contract that favors things that bug authors. And so sometimes as a publisher now, I can say, oh, like, the reason why publishers don't like to pay authors once a month is because it just takes a lot of time every month. And it'd be so much better to just pay them quarterly. But then I remember as an author how much I loved getting the month. You know, a month is much better for an author. So be that as it may, the books have been very popular. And very fun to create. A big challenge for us was, in fact, when Apple introduced iBooks, their ebook reading software.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenge was, in the past, there were devices and programs that could read ebooks in other formats besides the PDF. And in fact, we did make our books available in some of those other formats, but we didn't have especially good technology for that, and they were not especially good. But people were so grateful that they existed at all that they really didn't mind if they were a little weird or they had to go through strange rituals to get them installed on their ebook reader hardware. But man, when that iPad came out, people basically believed that, of course, Tanya and Adam and Tidbits would pretty much overnight figure out how to make a really great EPUB to read on the new iPad in the new iBooks. So we tackled that problem. It took us a while, but we now have a publication system where the author writes the book once in a nice WYSIWYG environment. What you see is what you get. So the author can see some reasonable semblance of the page layout while they're working. And then we have a very large collection of macros that allow us to create the PDF and the EPUB and, in fact, the Mobi Pocket, which you need for Amazon.
Right.
All from the same document. And it's been quite a lot of work behind the scenes to make that possible. But we do it.
So iBooks has been good for you?
You know, I think iBooks has been good for popularizing the idea of reading an ebook, and maybe to some extent popularizing the idea that an ebook could be reasonably professional. But in fact, the vast majority of our sales are just from our own website. We don't sell a lot of books on the iBook store, but they're all there. We don't mm-hmm. mind if people buy them there, mm-hmm. but most people come to us directly.
Cool. Well, speaking of coming to you directly, how do the authors come to you? Do you enlist authors to do a specific project that you have in mind, or do authors send you proposals out of the blue and say, I'd like to write a book about iTunes?
Some of both. Some of both, for sure. One thing we have learned is that being a publisher for an author writing a book, especially a technology book that is likely to need a lot of updates over the years, it is a significant commitment. It's a much bigger commitment than, you know, hey, let's have dinner, or hey, let's get together and, you know, give a joint talk at a conference. It's more like almost getting married. You're going to be with this person for a long time. You're going to make business decisions together. You're going to support difficult customers. And you sort of can't do it with just anybody. So if someone writes to me and says, hey, I got an idea for a book I'd like to write, you know, here's the idea, I send them over to Adam and I say, usually, you know, we would really like to work with you. This is a cool idea, because usually the people are cool and they have great ideas. And I say, let's see if we can do a couple articles together. And then we'll talk about a book, because sort of you can learn a lot about each other's yeah. working styles. And you may discover that a book is perfect, or you may discover that you just don't like each other that much. A book
or
is
that
hard.
The author didn't really understand the commitment and the effort, or the level of effort that it was going to take.
The books are hard. Yeah. I'll be quite frank. Writing a real book that fits together, that answers a lot of questions, that requires research, it's hard. And it's even harder when you write this whole book. And even though we can publish the book very quickly, it still can be basically pretty outdated in, you know, 2 weeks, 2 months, you know, maybe author, a year.
How does the author submit his book to you? Is there a lot of editing on your end, or do you have a template for the author?
We have an elaborate template. As I said, the authors do, we work in a software called Nisus Writer Pro, which is a Macintosh word processor. Mm-hmm. It gives them, as I said, a what you see is what you get environment. So if they're crafting a tip, or they're crafting a caption, something that is text but it has a visual component, they can see what it's going to look like on the page or on the screen right as they go. I think that's really important. I had some experiences when writing books where I was writing into a Word manuscript that just had nothing at all to do with the final layout. And sometimes I would make tips that were too long, or just things that looked weird in the layout. And if I'd been able to see the layout, I just would have never written it that way. So it's very important to me that our authors have access to a WYSIWYG environment so they can tell what they're doing. So they work in Nisus Writer Pro. There is a lot of editing. I've been editing these books now for almost 15 years, and I have pretty much figured out what I think is the best way to solve all kinds of writing problems. And we have a large style guide, and we work hard to have the facts be correct. So there's all kinds of editing. There's copy editing and proofreading, of course, but we also try to think about how to get the books tech edited efficiently, whether we want to bring in an expert who can make sure that we've got the fundamentals right, or we want to bring in a couple of people who are not that familiar with the topic so they can try all the steps and see if it all works for them. Mm-hmm. So that's a challenge, because often we'll have the book will be maybe 30% written. We'll start editing on that first 30% while the author keeps going, because there's so much time pressure. The book's all being about, you know, products that Apple is making, or apps that are being revised constantly. So we don't have a lot of time to sit around and make it perfect. We want it to be perfect, but we also want it to be available to people before everything changes again.
If you have an editor who looks over somebody else's work, sort of a peer review, do you pay them to?
Yes, absolutely. We pay our author, our editors on a per page basis. That's because the IRS says that's how we have to do it. And I think they're compensated pretty well. We certainly look for people who can really do a high quality job for us. For some of the editing where it's just kind of, we need a person who doesn't know that much about the product, I have a set of friends and relatives and that kind of thing. And some people I pay them and some people just do it because, you know, they're my friend and they want to look at a couple chapters of a book and get a chance to learn about something that they need to know about so they can get their job done.
Cool. Well, this has been a fascinating story, the background that led you up to this and how you do your books. But we're just about out of time, Tanya, so we're going to have to wrap it up. Is there anything else at the last minute you'd like to cover that we didn't get in?
No, I guess I'd just like to say for people listening who haven't come to the Take Control website in a while, we're at www.takecontrolbooks.com. And we just published a book about how to completely take control of your password situation as far as creating secure passwords that are excellent. Really easy to make. So come check us out. And it's just always a pleasure to get to tell people about how I got this job that I've made up along the way.
Are you on Twitter?
Yes, I am. Tanya Engst, TonyaEngst.
Excellent. Tanya, thank you very much for being on the show and telling us your story. It's quite an experience you've had and quite an ongoing business you've created. And the whole community thanks you for what you do. I don't think there's anybody who doesn't know about you and your books and what you've done and the contributions you've made. So thank you for that. And listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show today. Thank you for coming by. We'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.